Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're diving into something that's, well, it's literally all around us, the silent language of space and territory.
Exactly. And we've got this great collection of insights here, almost like a mini lecture, really,
Right.
that helps explain how we use, perceive, and instinctively protect the physical spaces around us.
It's pretty fascinating when you think about it. We're navigating this world where our physical environment and how we relate to it is constantly sending messages. Understanding this kind of hidden language can give you some, well, really surprising insights into behavior.
Yeah, into how we interact, how we feel. So our mission for this deep dive is basically to pull out the key concepts from this material, give you a shortcut to understanding these powerful, often subconscious ways space really impacts our lives.
Okay, so where do we begin? I guess the foundational idea is territoriality.
Right, territoriality. And it's maybe more relevant now than ever, you know,
Yeah.
with privacy feeling harder to come by, is this this deep-seated idea that there are pieces of territory spaces that we feel are ours, and we feel this need to protect them.
And it's not just like your whole house, is it? The material points out that even inside a shared space, like a home, we carve out little separate territories.
Exactly. For privacy. Think about maybe your bedroom or even just a specific chair, you know, dad's den, grandma's spot at the table, that kind of thing.
Little micro territories.
That's a good way to put it. And that's different from what's called personal space.
Ah, the bubble.
Yeah, that invisible sort of variable bubble we carry around. It changes size depending on the situation who we're with.
You definitely know when someone violates it, though. A stranger getting too close, you feel it immediately. Maybe threatened, uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely. The material talks about this triggering an almost automatic response, needing to protect yourself or avoid the situation.
And if you can't physically move away.
Then you do it psychologically, like avoiding eye contact. It's a way of creating distance even when there isn't physical space, a kind of mental boundary.
It's amazing how layered this is. So this idea of my space, it breaks down into different types, doesn't it?
It does. The material lays out three main types of territory. The most personal one is primary territory.
Okay.
These are spaces we see as exclusively ours, really hard to give up or share easily. Your home, maybe your car, personal things like your wallet, your phone.
Things deeply tied to you.
Exactly. Deeply tied to identity.
Makes sense. So that's primary. What comes next?
Next is secondary territory. These are places or objects we don't own, not really, but we temporarily claim them or associate strongly with them.
Okay,
Like your usual desk at work if it's an open office, or maybe your side of the couch at home, or even a book you're reading, or the knife and fork you're using. It's temporary.
right, it's more situational. Got it. And the third type.
Public territory. These are spaces open to pretty much everyone. Think a park bench, a spot on the beach, a parking space you just found.
You can claim it temporarily just by being there.
Precisely. Anyone could use it, but you're using it right now, and that sets up a temporary claim.
And we don't just sit there quietly hoping people respect these territories, do we? We signal it. We use markers.
Yes, we stake out our claims. The material highlights three kinds of markers. First, central markers.
Like putting your bag on the seat next to you.
Exactly that. Or your coffee cup on a table at a cafe. Your towel on the beach chair, the classic example. It signals this spot is taken.
Got it. Central markers. What else?
Then you have boundary markers. These are things that will divide territory, like fences between houses, hedges, maybe the little dividers in office cubicles. They create an edge.
A visible line.
Right. And finally, ear markers. These literally mark ownership. A nameplate, an address label, maybe a monogram on a shirt. It clearly says, this belongs to me.
So, central boundary and ear markers. It's interesting. The material also connects how much we feel the need to use these markers with how comfortable or vulnerable we feel.
Yeah, that's a key point. The more vulnerable or maybe insecure you feel in a situation, the larger the space you might want, and the more you might rely on these markers to kind of build a barrier.
Trying to create a secure zone.
Exactly. But when you feel safe, comfortable, relaxed,
Yeah.
you're often less worried about defending your space. The boundaries can soften up a bit.
Okay, but what about when those boundaries are challenged? When protection fails? That's where territorial encroachments come in, right?
Right. These are actions that infringe on someone else's territory or their right to use it. And they're not all the same. The material breaks them down into three kinds based on severity.
Okay, what's first?
Territorial violation. This is basically intruding into someone's primary territory without permission. The example given is like a roommate borrowing your clothes without asking.
crossing a line.
Definitely. Then there's territorial invasion. This is more serious, more intentional. It's a takeover of territory.
Like the example of one country invading another.
Exactly. A full-scale takeover.
Yep.
Very different from borrowing a sweater.
And the third one.
Territorial contamination. This isn't about taking the space, but damaging it or making it less desirable. Spilling something on someone's couch, leaving a mess.
Mm-hmm.
It ruins the territory for the owner, at least temporarily.
And how we react to these encroachments, it's not always the same, is it?
No, it really depends. Context is everything.
Like who did it? Friend or stranger?
Absolutely. That matters hugely. And why did they do it? Did they feel they had no choice? Was it an accident or deliberate?
And is it a one-off or is this going to keep happening? A temporary problem versus a permanent one?
All these factors shape how we perceive it and how we respond, which leads us nicely into proxemics.
The science of distance, how close we actually stand to people.
Yeah. How much space do we reserve around ourselves? It really depends on the relationship, doesn't it?
It does. So the material talks about Hall's work here, the different distance zones.
That's right. Edward Hall identified four main distances we tend to use. First up is intimate distance.
Touching to about 18 inches, right. Very close. For private, informal interactions.
Exactly. Reserved for those closest to us. Then there's personal distance.
About 18 inches to 4 feet. Your personal bubble zone.
Yeah, that's your typical distance for friends, family, people you know well. Comfortable conversation distance.
Okay.
Social distance. This is further out, maybe 4 to 12 feet. More for impersonal business, group meetings, professional or social gatherings where you maintain a bit more formality.
Right. Less personal. And the furthest.
Public distance. That's 12 feet and beyond. Really out to the limit of where you can easily see or hear someone. Think public speaking. Addressing a large group.
Makes sense. But it's not just the relationship that determines these distances, is it? There are other factors.
Oh, definitely. Several variables influence how we manage space. Gender is one. The research tends to show women, on average, use and need slightly less space.
Interesting. And women talking to women stand closer than men talking to men.
That's often observed, yes.
Mm-hmm.
A woman's personal bubble might generally be a bit smaller. Age matters, too. We tend to stand closer to people our own age.
And personality.
Big factor. Anxious or introverted people often maintain more distance. Relaxed, extroverted people might be comfortable closer up.
And, logically, liking and familiarity. You stand closer to people you know and like.
Of course. But a really crucial point here is that these zones, Hall's distances, they are not universal. They are heavily influenced by culture.
Right. What feels normal in one culture might feel way too close or awkwardly far in another.
Absolutely. And that affects behavior, comfort levels, everything. When someone violates those culturally learned expectations about distance.
Yeah, it feels weird, uncomfortable, stressful even.
It can make you feel vulnerable. And if you can't physically adjust the space, you start doing other things, shifting your body, maybe using objects as barriers, avoiding eye contact, trying to regain some comfort.
Which links to this other idea, expectancy violations theory.
Exactly. We have these expectations about how people should behave nonverbally, including how close they should stand.
And when they break that expectation, stand way closer or further away than you anticipate for that situation.
It grabs your attention. It triggers a response. You notice it immediately.
And how we react depends on how we feel about the person, right?
Definitely. If you already like the person, you might interpret the violation positively. Maybe they're being friendly or emphatic. But if you have negative feelings about them,
then that same violation feels much worse, more negative, maybe even threatening.
Precisely. Our perception of the person colors our interpretation of the space violation.
This all feeds into how we experience crowding and density, too. The material draws a distinction here.
Yes, a very important one. Density is physical, just the sheer number of people per unit of space. Think of a packed elevator. That's high density.
Okay. But crowding.
Crowding is psychological.
Mm.
It's the feeling of your space being invaded, the negative perception of that density. You can be in a dense space, like a concert, and not feel crowded if you're enjoying it. Or you could feel crowded in a less dense space if someone's right in your bubble.
So density is objective, crowding is subjective.
You got it.
Yeah.
And living in constantly high-density places, like some huge cities versus low-density areas, it affects behavior.
How so?
Well, people in very high-density environments often develop ways to cope. They might limit interactions with strangers, be more reserved, kind of create psychological barriers because physical ones aren't possible.
And that could be seen as unfriendly sometimes.
It could, yeah. It might look like they're being curt or ignoring common courtesies, but it's often just a necessary strategy to manage the constant closeness, a way to maintain some psychological space.
Okay, so shifting gears slightly, the final big piece is how the environment itself sends messages, arranging space.
Right. The physical setting itself is a huge nonverbal communicator. It influences our mood, our behavior, how we interact. Think about how different you feel walking into a, say, stark, formal courtroom versus a cozy coffee shop.
Completely different vibe.
And the material points out three facets to any environment. The natural setting, who else is there, not there, and the architectural stuff.
Which includes design, but also movable things, furniture, lighting, color.
Exactly. Even sound and decorations. Mm-hmm. And how furniture is arranged, what's called fixed feature space like walls versus semi-fixed feature space like chairs and tables can really guide interaction.
Like chairs in a circle encourage talk, rows facing front discourage it.
Precisely. It can almost predetermine communication patterns. And we have emotional reactions based on the setting's perceived formality or informality.
Yeah, like the beautiful spaces versus ugly spaces idea. Good lighting, comfy furniture, nice colors make you feel better.
Feel more relaxed, maybe more open to communication. Whereas poor lighting, uncomfortable seating, drab colors, it can make you feel tense. Maybe you want to leave quicker.
And there's a framework for how we perceive these places. Knapp's work.
Yeah, Knapp and colleagues suggest we evaluate environments, often unconsciously, along six dimensions. How formal it feels, how warm, how private, how familiar, how constraining, like how much freedom you have to move, and how distant it feels. We're constantly sizing places up on these scales.
Wow, okay. So wrapping this all up, we've covered a lot. Territoriality claiming space, from primary to public. Protecting it with markers.
Then personal space, that invisible bubble, the different proximic distances, intimate, personal, social, public, and the factors like gender, age, personality, culture that shape them.
And what happens when those distances, those expectations are violated, how we react to encroachments, the difference between physical density and the feeling of crowding.
And finally, how the environment itself, its design, its arrangement, its aesthetics, is constantly communicating, shaping how we feel and interact within it.
It really underscores how fundamental this nonverbal language of space is. It's influencing us constantly, often without us even realizing it.
It really is. It's woven into the fabric of every interaction, every place we go.
So maybe here's something for you to think about as you go about your day. Notice how your use of space changes. How close do you stand to different people? How do you mark your territory at work or home? And do you start to notice now how different environments make you feel? Are those invisible boundaries becoming a little more visible?